Hello, and welcome to the interview of Bill Diekman. Bill is the writer who worked with Margarita Frey on Marissa's Courage. Hello, Bill, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. And hi, Sun Sounds listeners.
I'm wondering today about what brought you to even considering writing this book, Marissa's Courage.
Well, it wasn't this book in particular, but I've always had a passion for writing, even in an engineering background. I used to write a lot of technical reports, and then I got into sales and marketing and write contracts and things like that. So I always had a passion for language. In fact, I always think back to my eighth grade school teacher, Justina Murphy, back in Rosedale, Queens, New York.
Wow.
She taught me how to diagram a sentence, and that passion has just stayed with me. I just see sentences diagrammed. But the interest in this book arose when, as a navigator, a volunteer at Sky Harbor Airport here in Phoenix, I worked a location with Margarita's daughter, Angie, one day, and we had not known each other up until that point. So we just chatted, and I mentioned the fact that I had just taken a creative writing course. She said, oh, my mother wants to write a book about her life. She was in the resistance movement in Italy during the Second World War. Her native language not being English, it doesn't come out so good. I've tried to help her, but so on and so on. So I suggested that Margarita, Angie's mother, give me a call, and I'd be happy to go up and edit some of the things that she'd written. So shortly after the holidays that year, I went up to Scottsdale, took about 8 pages of Margarita's writings, took a week, edited them, brought them back, and both she and Angie were delighted at what I'd done. But the more I talked with them, especially Margarita, the more I realized there was so much more to her life than what was in these 8 pages. So I agreed that we would get to work together on a book about her life, and it started there.
And did you find that Margarita was very easy to talk with, or did she kind of withhold information?
It was a bit of both, actually. There were certain experiences in her life she was very eager to speak about, and there were others where there were just some hesitations because the memories were not 100% wonderful. There were times, and getting to know her, I learned how then to phrase questions, mm-hmm. to extract some responses. And I recorded all of this, so there was a lot of listening when I went home, and I had to then sort of rephrase some of the things that she had said. And the other interesting part about recording these things, I went up about every week for a year and a half, and we sat for maybe 2 hours and recorded, was that she didn't tell her story in chronological order. She would tell a story and that would remind her of something else and she would speak of that. It's the way most of us do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would go home and I would simply type up and file what she had talked about. And then, oh, maybe 2 months into it, she told me a story that said, oh, wow, this fits just in front of that other story she told me. So now I could file that on the same document, but ahead of what I'd previously written. And more or less, that's how the rest of the story got constructed, just like building a wall with holes in it, and then you just plug, oh, this brick belongs here, this brick belongs there.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And Margarita, I understand, is elderly, that she has lived, excess of 90 years?
She was 87 when the book was written, and she's now 92.
Wow.
She's very spry, alert, sharp as a tack. Unfortunately, she has dry macular degeneration. So mm-hmm. when we're together, and I still go up there and visit her every once in a while, once a month maybe, she says, I can't see your face, which is devastating for her because, not because I'm so good looking, but she's a painter.
Uh-huh.
And she's got a collection of hundreds of paintings. And the style is becoming a bit more abstract because the details are not as easy for her to do anymore, mm-hmm. but she still keeps at it. She's very spry, she's mentally sharp and energetic and just a wonderful person to know.
Well, when you were writing and she was jumping around like that, how did you capture her so that she stayed on track?
Well, oftentimes she would complete describing something and then you would see her mind wandering. So I would go back to some of the things she had just said and say, well, what happened next after that? Or what happened to this person? Do you know, are you still in contact with that person? Something like that, just to get her back on. And it's not because it was any particular shortcoming on her part. It's just that's the way we think about things.
Yeah.
But I just began to be able to read her face and her body language and know when I wanted her to let go and wander on to something else because we'd covered the previous, or I wanted some more details to finish what we had just talked about.
Is she still in contact with anybody that she talked about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, you know, obviously at the age of 92, her forebears are gone, but there are still some contacts in Italy with whom she talks on the telephone.
Wow.
She's not adept at computer or, you know, texting or anything like that, but she speaks with them on the telephone. Some folks she went to school with, some people that she'd known because of visits that she'd made back to Italy after she came to the United States. So yeah, yeah, that's still alive.
Well, when you were reading her, when you were writing her story and listening to her tell her story, what was it that actually grabbed you the most? I know you read those 8 pages to begin with,
sure.
But was there something in there that was striking, or was it more in sitting down and talking to her?
It was the latter. The pages that she'd written about were not incredibly detailed, so it was, they stimulated me to ask her questions.
Mm-hmm.
And when she started to fill in the details, it was then that I realized there was so much below the surface of these pages of writing that I needed to explore, first just out of pure fascination on my part, but then it began to gel as an idea for a book.
Was it difficult to decide which story or which event or which experience that she was talking about to pick for the book? Was it, how did you go about deciding that?
The theme that was in the back of my mind was that, I mean, here was a woman of 87 years of age who'd spent 2 years in the resistance. So it was a very small portion of her life. But it was so dramatic. It was so intense that it shaped, first of all, her willingness to participate at that was a reflection of her previous, you know, of her upbringing. But then what happened to her later in life was so influenced by those 2 years of experience. So I would try to leverage stories from her experiences there to how did that affect you later on? What, you know, did this make it more difficult for you to do this sort of thing? Or did that become easier? Or what about the people that were involved in these particular stories? Mm-hmm. Are they still around? That sort of thing. It was like going into a gold mine. It was just wonderful.
Well, I know when I read that section of the book in a good book, that it was very fascinating, especially the time when she was, I don't know if you'd use the word captured, but she was stopped by those investigators and they patted her down just where.
Well, this was an interesting story because she said her role was in the Italian word staffetta, S-T-A-F-F-E. T-A or one F and two T's, I can't recall. But this was a courier. So she and a lot of young women like her would carry weapons and ammunition and special reports and things like that on their bicycles all over town to little group meetings, sometimes out into the hills to the soldiers, to the fighters themselves. And then one day she was going to carry some guns and some bullets to some fighters. And ordinarily on her bicycle, she would string a bag between the handlebars and put the weapons and whatever she was carrying in that bag. And she said, on this one day, my mother said to me, maybe you want to put these on your body, you know, stick them down inside, frankly, stick them down inside your underwear, which is what she did. She got stopped. It was the only time she'd ever been stopped to be searched. And these German soldiers frisked her top to bottom, but only on her sides. They never patted down her stomach or anything. And so they would have found these weapons. And as she said to me, and as I wrote in the book, if they had found those weapons, Marisa, her code name in the resistance movement, would not have lived any further and there would be no book. So that was a day where, you know, imminent death was rolling around in her head.
I'm sure that had to have made an impact for the rest of her life.
And it wasn't the first time either. There's another story in there that you probably recall where she was riding on her bicycle and suddenly she got stopped and pulled off her bicycle and pulled. She described it, it was a big brick wall probably outside a Fiat automotive factory. And there were two young boys up against the wall. And these two German soldiers, these two guys were tied together. And these German soldiers made her look while they shot them both to death and then sent her on her way on the bicycle. They told her to run. So she ran with her bike, not on the bike, but with the bike alongside her. And they fired bullets at her. She could hear them whizzing by her head. She never could figure out whether they were just enjoying themselves, whether they wanted to have her run back and spread the message to other potential resistance people not to run afoul of the Germans. Mm-hmm. She never knew. But she did tell me that she has that dream of that scene very, very often.
Sure.
So it's, you know, again, experiences that probably the most of us couldn't even contemplate.
Right, and something like that definitely haunts you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did she ever talk about, did she know those boys?
No, she didn't know who they were. But the way she described them to me, I mean, it was in horribly vivid detail about what happened to them as they were shot, as the bullets hit them, as they fell. It was really gruesome.
As a writer, when you hear a story like that, I'm sure it definitely churns you up.
Absolutely.
But I wonder how then you figure out how you're going to write that. Are you going to write it as gruesomely as it was told? Are you going to actually add more, I don't know what you'd call it, but maybe oomph to that story so it's even over the top from what you heard? Or are you going to downplay it? What do you do as a writer?
Everything. First of all, I write just freestyle. I'm listening to it. I'm writing. And then I'll reread it. And I'll edit things. I will move sentences around. I will take sentences out. I will look at certain words and think, this was really more dramatic. So I'll go to Roger's thesaurus and find a more suitable word to use in that case, just to make sure that the emotional level that this person in the story experienced is to some degree felt by the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And the first reader is me, because I'm reading what I've just written.
Sure.
And how's it hitting me? So I don't think much ahead of time. I just write, and then I look at what I've written and start to chip away or restructure and move things around.
Do you have any, because people have images, sometimes they're visual images, sometimes they're auditory images, like you could hear the bullets, or sometimes people even have tactile images, mm-hmm. where they feel the impact,
yeah.
of the bullet. Does any of that happen when you're listening to a story like that?
I can't say that it does. I come from a technical scientific background, so even though writing would not be considered something you're going to get in engineering school, my mind is very analytical. I mm-hmm. tend to just look and examine facts. And yes, I understand that you could hear the bullet go by, and I can probably hear it in my ear if I tried real hard. But that's not part of me. I'm just dealing with facts, and then I want the facts to have an emotional impact. I want people to come to what I aim at when I write more than anything else is I don't want a reader to say, let me go back and read that again. I can't remember, or I wasn't clear on what I read. I want it to flow like water.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep flowing, keep flowing, keep flowing. The writer never has to go back a page. So that's sort of what I do. And my hoped for means of doing that is just to make it as descriptive as possible. I try to use as many different kinds of words. I like to structure sentences in such a way that if it's dramatic, it's short. If it's building up to something, it's a little longer. And then dramatic climax is a short, bangy sentence,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. But again, that's almost more of a mechanical engineering approach to things than a passionate one. But when I read it then, I sense how I'm feeling when I'm reading what I've written. But it's not happening when I'm writing.
That's interesting. So you write it, let's say you write it as an engineer, but you read it as a person who's purchased a book and is reading it.
Absolutely.
So yeah. You almost split yourself in half to...
I am bilateral or whatever.
You're two different people.
I can be. My wife always wonders which one I am today.
Well, what, do you ever find that the technical Bill gets ahead of the emotional Bill? And I mean emotional in terms of writing emotions. That you want to describe that in that scene that she's just painted where these boys are shot. You want to be so technical about it that you worry about what kind of gun they used, what kind of bullets they used, what distance they were from the person.
As I suggested earlier, it's not ahead of my writing. As I'm writing, sometimes I can sense, oops, I'm getting into too much technical detail. I'm more concerned about right angles and circles and diameters and things than I am with feelings or weather or, you know, sounds. And I catch myself in the middle of it and say, whoops, back up.
Okay.
And so it's a discipline. I think we all have our own disciplines that are unique to us, and that's what mine is.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I find that fascinating that you come from the technical background, but then you can work in something that is very emotional.
Well, you know, it's funny. As a kid, I wanted to be an airline pilot. And so I went to a high school in Brooklyn that had aeronautics program. My degree is in aeronautical engineering. 6 months prior to graduating from college, I went to sign up in the Air Force to get into pilot training, and I found out I'm colorblind. Ever so remotely colorblind. Today it's correctable by lenses. In 1964 it was not. And that was the end of that career. And I often wondered, if I'd known that sooner, would I have gone into some other field? Would I have gone into something a bit more artistic or less technical and precise? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I didn't, and I am what I am, and I'm making the most of it.
Well, that's good. What, if any, stories that you did write in Marissa's Courage did you think about putting in and then make a decision for whatever reason not to put them into the book?
As I'd mentioned to you before we went on air, there was a story that Margarita confided in me. And I actually did write it, but when she read it, because once I would write something, I would print out a copy, and the next time we were together, I'd bring it so she could mark it up or whatever she wanted. And when she looked at this, it was a deeply personal, private thing, and she asked me not to put that in the book. Obviously, I'm not going to tell you what those details are, but yeah, there were one or two of those kinds of instances where it was a mutual decision.
Mm-hmm.
I was willing to put it in there, but I was also willing to take it out if she wanted, and that's the way we went.
I wonder if, and I don't know that you know this, but I wonder if her telling you those deeply personal stories was just a way for her to kind of get them out, let somebody else know, and in some way almost get rid of the, I call it garbage, get rid of the garbage so that she could have a clearer mind, a freer heart.
I think there was an element of that in there. Obviously, for a year and a half, once a week going up there, we became pretty close friends. And as the time went by and as she was seeing what I was doing with this, she felt more comfortable talking about some things. There were occasions where she said, please turn the recorder off, because she just wanted to tell me something that was important to her, but she didn't feel it belonged in the book. So, yeah, there were times like that where I think she was more and more comfortable with our personal relationship because of the things she'd already told me and the way I was reacting to them and handling them. She got more comfortable with that. So, yeah, from time to time, she confided some things in me that more times than not didn't get in the book.
So then I wonder, again, as a writer, you start out as just a professional. You walk into her home or wherever it was you recorded it, and you sit down and you open your notebook or your tape recorder and you say, let's talk. But then, as over a year and a half, you're still the professional, but you become the friend.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, does that influence the writing? Do you have to fight with yourself to stay professional? Do you have to, when you get down to business of recording and talking to her again, do you have to almost put on a different pair of shoes when you're talking to her?
It's a good question. I hadn't really thought about that. So I said we became very good friends. And one of the things that was important for me was I'm always interested in learning. Mm-hmm. And so there was so many details. As I've even said in the book, I grew up in New York City, actually in the Second World War. I was born in 1943. And so there were a lot of fresh European immigrants all around me. It was mm-hmm. just a fact that you knew the ethnic background of every one of your friends. And I had had this opinion of Italians that was, as I said in the book, she upgraded and upbraided my opinions because I was unaware of the significance of what these folks had done. And I began to research a lot more Italian history. But the other thing that was fascinating was Margherita is a collector. She has photographs that go back way back into the 1930s. She doesn't throw anything away. She's got her wedding gown still. There are so many things. And a lot of going over those pictures and documents that she'd saved is what helped stimulate my interest in asking certain questions and would also revive memories that she had that would lead to a story, mm-hmm. a piece of her life. Yeah. And so it was a multidimensional experience. You know, we were using obviously the auditory part of it, but there was so much that was visual. She has old newspapers, just incredible collection of things.
And she's got, or you've got some wonderful pictures within the book itself.
Yeah. And what we wanted to make sure of was that a lot of these pictures, not only were her family photographs, but others of them were published in newspapers or magazines. And I wanted to make sure that we had the permission of those people. So the book ended up in a library in Torino, which is where she was from, in recompense for them giving us permission to use actually the material that's on the front cover of the book. Pictures from Liberation Day in mm-hmm. April 25th, 1945 in Torino. So that was a lot of fun as well. And this was a really interesting experience. I used Google Translate. I wrote my letter in English, and then on the back of it, I put the Google translation in Italian just to make sure.
That's very interesting.
It was such a neat experience. Yeah. And it's something we couldn't have done 10, 15 years ago.
That's true.
Yeah.
I noticed in the book as I was reading it that there were times when you broke from the story as
right.
the author, and then you talked about the history. And I found that fascinating. I mean, I really appreciate that you did that.
One of the things, the book was edited by a lady who actually was a friend of somebody at KBAQ here in Rio Salado. And she edited it, and she said, those pieces that you wrote that were sort of background for providing the historical tableau on which her life was being played out, you really want to separate that some way. So you'll notice that those were all in italics, mm-hmm. and that was her brilliant suggestion. One of the things I was very cautious about is telling one person's story against a history that many people experienced. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get any of that history wrong mm-hmm. so that somebody would read that and say, oh, it didn't happen that way, so that book must be bunk. I didn't want there to be any questions about the veracity of what I was writing about Margherita's life because some background or accompanying historical fact was misread or misplaced. So I did a lot of research. Interesting, one of the books that I did that is in the bibliography is called The Other Italy, and it was written by Maria de Blasio Wilhelm. That is Mayor de Blasio's mother from New York City. She married a German fellow, the last name Wilhelm, and the mayor, this is just a side story, it's got nothing to do with our book here, but
that's all right.
The mayor apparently did not have a good relationship with his father, and so he legally changed his name to de Blasio. But in fact, Margherita wrote to Mrs. de Blasio and or de Blasio Wilhelm, and of course she had read the book, and this was before she contemplated, before Margarita contemplated a book of her own. She wrote this letter and was very grateful, and the woman sent her an autographed copy back to Margarita. And I use that as a reference, as well as several other books in there. Just a lot of internet searching as well. I've got a carton at home of everything that built up over the year and a half, the 2 years it took us to put this book together, just with background reference information. So it was, again, a huge learning experience for me.
The other part of that is, in all of that research, and maybe you did this as a technical writer, but in all of that research, you've got to figure out what to pluck out that is going to be pertinent to the story, as well as to the uninformed reader in terms of what they know about the Italian participation in the war.
Absolutely. What I felt was, when I was researching these things and having to decide what pieces to put in there, is, did it make it any easier to feel and understand and accept what happened to Margarita and the people with whom she was interacting in those days? Did it help set the mood? Did it help people understand what the emotions were at the time? Because emotions drive us into so much of what we do in life. There were very, very strange, unprecedented emotions going on there. I mean, there is a segment of the book I wrote about where she was in her apartment with her mother, mother's apartment, and they heard this commotion outside. And because of the air raids, there were these dark drapes over all the windows, so they just stood to the side of the window and pulled the drape back to look outside into the street. It was raining out, and there was a guy running down the middle of the street in a raincoat, but it was open and it was flapping behind him like a big wing or something. And then suddenly she heard crack, and this guy just fell face down into the street. And a few seconds later, a German soldier walked up with a rifle and kicked the body to see if it was alive. And at that point, Margarita and her mother decided they needed to get out of the building, because they figured the Nazis would come in and go to every door, every apartment, to see if anybody had witnessed this. So they quickly put on their coats and went out a back door and went out to a shelter or something. But again, having witnessed that, would in ordinary times, would we say that represents a potential threat to us? In those days, it did. So trying to put those kinds of stories or backgrounds, what was going on in the immediate area, that part of Italy at the time, that influenced how and why people did what they did.
And then that thinking not only stays at that point in time.
Oh, yeah.
Like you said earlier, it follows them throughout their lifetime. So
it must be very difficult to give that up or be able to shut the door on that.
Yeah, yeah. Wondering if you see something out the window, whether or not you're safe.
Yeah, yeah. So, and her life, at least for those two very intense years, were full of things like that. And actually, we didn't put as much in the book of this, but the years leading up to the war under Mussolini and the fascists weren't all fun and games either. So she had a very intense life.
And then when she married the fellow who didn't speak her language and she didn't speak his language, that was also so very, very complicated. How do you have a relationship with somebody that you can't even speak to?
Even today, Margarita puzzles over that. The details are, after the war, in the apartment building where her parents lived and she lived with them, there was a guy who had a band, and the singer that was scheduled to do a performance at a club up in the hills one evening was unavailable, indisposed. And Margarita sang, not professionally, but she sang in the apartment. And then when the warm weather was there, the windows were open, this guy had heard her sing, so asked her mother if she would let Margarita come and perform. So she did, and it was at one of these performances that these two U.S. soldiers, this was still maybe spring of 1945, after the war was over, these two guys are there watching, and they start to flirt with her. And one of the guys ends up, he's driving a Jeep, and the whole band and their instruments get shoved into this Jeep. Things must have been hanging out everywhere. And they drive back into Torino and drop Margarita off. And one of these soldiers says to the parents, I come back. I go home to U.S. I come back. I marry your daughter. And the father, who spoke some English, said, you go home. Maybe you have wife. You stay there. So, but at any rate, the guy did come back. There were so many incidental things that happened that led to the next and the next and the next. The day after they had been at this club, she was going to her job in Torino, and she was on the trolley but missed her stop and got off at the very next stop. Who's at the next stop, coincidentally, but these two guys, these two soldiers in their Jeep? They spot her, they call her over. If she had gotten off at her regular stop, she'd have never seen them, and things might not have progressed any further.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy wrote out, he took a checkbook and tore a check out, and on the back of it wrote his name and his address, and again promised that he would come back and marry her. He's talking in very broken Italian. She's understanding a little bit of English because she'd been studying it, but not much. And sure enough, the guy goes back to the United States, starts sending her letters, postcards. Mama dictates her responses.
Her mother was unbelievably
dictatorial.
Yes.
And she saw, and I think there was some benevolence here. She saw for Margarita the possibility of a better life marrying an American, because right then in Italy, as in most of Europe, it was pretty devastated. And the prospects for a future life were unknown. And if you had any thoughts about them at all, they probably were not positive. Mm-hmm. So she saw this as an out for her daughter. So she managed this relationship from afar. It was a one-year correspondence. And the guy, promised he would come back. And suddenly they get a telephone call or a telegram, I can't recall now, that he's in London. And he's on his way down, and he would be in Torino in 2 days, and so on and so forth. So they could meet him at the rail station. And this guy comes across like Mr. Hollywood. He's from California, and he's dressed in a tan suit with a Panama hat and six pieces of luggage that are trimmed in gold. And this just really turns Mama on to thinking, wow, this is the guy for her. This is the guy for Margarita. But it turns out he was somewhat flawed. In the end of the book, I let Margarita contemplate the reality. First of all, we had done an awful lot of information trying to search down this guy's background, and it was just one dead end after another. We knew confidently absolutely nothing about this guy before he came into Margarita's life. We were unable to confirm anything about him.
Even his name.
Even his name, yeah. So what she suspected was that his life prior to then had not been a happy life, not one in which he was made to feel good about himself. So he created this artifice, this Hollywood big star, Hollywood producer, big-time operator persona. And that seemed to catch everybody's attention, which is what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But there was really very little of it to back up. So from time to time during their 16-plus years of marriage, their lives would go off the rails. He even ended up in jail for a while. He was alcoholic. And nevertheless, even today, Margarita will say, I am still touched by the feelings that I had for this guy. And I've compared, this is a line I remember, when I compare him to other men I've met, they all come up underneath him. Even today.
Mm-hmm.
So,
despite the kind of life that he put her through, because she was, what I found interesting in what you wrote about pretty regularly throughout, there was the theme that when he would disappear or when he would lose a business, Margarita would hop to it. She could sew. She could do costume design. She could paint. She would do whatever it took to make that family survive.
She was very resourceful.
Yeah. And the trips back and forth to Italy to visit mom, to leave mom, every time she would find a way. She was, I mean, I think the word resilience really, really fits Margarita.
She had little self-confidence prior to that part of her life. Mm-hmm. She felt herself subservient to her mother, subservient to her husband. But it was when she was just literally booted into reality by his failings, she just stepped up to it. And she did what needed to be done and took care of her family.
But then when he'd come back or when Mama said something, she'd go right back into that subservient role again.
Yep.
So she rode a roller coaster throughout her lifetime.
I think what happens to us as we grow up, so much of our lifelong personality is a product of what we were exposed to as young kids when our brains were clear and everything that came into it was new and took deep root. Even as you learned contradictory things later in life, it was hard to give up what you'd first learned as a child. And I think that image of herself is what stayed with her even today. She gives voice to that feeling that she is sort of an underling, that other people are more important than she is. But she experienced these feelings of self-reliance and resilience because she had to.
Mm-hmm.
She had no choice. There was nobody else there to think. I mean, she was in this country, still not fluent in English, with no family. She had no choice but to call on herself.
And then when Mom was supposed to come and help her with her pregnancies, or Mom would come and Mom would leave. It was
Mom took over.
Yeah.
And she even remarked, there was a point where the baby, this was Angie, was having some difficulty. She was colicky, and the mother would either write or call to a doctor that she knew in Torino to get advice on how to do this. And her husband finally stepped in and said, listen, the baby's going to get care from doctors here in California, not in Italy. And Mama's response was, well, then I guess I'm not needed here. I'm going home. And next day she was gone.
Yeah.
Just harumph.
So, yeah, Margarita had people all the time, basically important people in her life, telling her, you do it my way or it's the highway.
Yeah.
And yet when those people left, Margarita made her own highway.
She filled the void.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's an amazing person. She really is. And I feel very blessed. Not because I wrote the book, but I got to meet this lady.
Yeah.
She's just such a unique person.
Well, in terms of what she did, that's what I found amazing, because she cobbled together all of her various skill sets and made them work. The one story that you write when she was approached by some entertainers, I don't remember if I'm right when I say Tony Bennett, but it was one
Tony Martin.
Yeah. One of the entertainers said, I need this costume. And Margarita didn't say no.
Yeah.
She just said, okay, if this is something that you need, I'm going to figure out how to do it.
There's the other story where she had the shop there in Sausalito. And two guys come in and they say, we're in a movie and we're going to have a fight. And the sleeves of our costumes are to be torn off in the fight. So she had to make, these are actually police uniforms, where the sleeves were attached to the body of the coat just with simple basting so that they could be torn apart. So she does that. The two guys come back. They pick up the costumes and out they go. 2 minutes later, a friend of hers comes into the shop. She says, do you know who that was that just came out of your shop? That was Stacy Keach and George C. Scott. She didn't know who they were. Stacy Keach came back, gave her an autographed photo of himself, and she still has that today. She has so many things that she's clung on to because they are markers in her life.
Mm-hmm. You know? And in the restaurant business, too, she was able to hop to it there. And
right.
I don't think she had much background at all in restauranting.
Except in the suburb of Torino, Stura, where her grandmother, Gremo, They had a restaurant there, and every once in a while she would go over there, and she said it was not like I was going to visit my grandmother. I was going to over there to be assigned work to do by my grandmother, which was just a lot of background work in the kitchen or in the storeroom in this restaurant. So she had that level of confidence. But the interesting tidbit that she adds to it is, even as I would prepare meals to serve, I would call out and put them on the counter for the waiters to come up. And then I would duck down so that the waiters don't have a chance to talk with me because I was so unconfident about my English.
Yeah, but she certainly, despite her English problems, she didn't have any difficulty making a living for that family.
No, no. She's had some tragedy in her life as well.
One daughter with the drug addiction?
Drug addiction, alcoholism, who unfortunately was hit by a car here in Scottsdale.
Oh.
And died about 6 weeks later, never regaining consciousness. But she was under the influence when that happened. She was just crossing a street. So yeah, that was that kind of tragedy. And not to overlook losing her husband, even as with all his failings, just losing him and watching him go downhill.
Yeah, because he went downhill because of the alcoholism.
Absolutely, yeah. And what seems so tragic is when he was on his game, he was actually quite competent and quite successful and quite resourceful, because some of these businesses that he had while he was up and not under the influence and things like that, businesses were very well run, they were very successful, and so on and so forth. But eventually he would give in and start to go down, and then the business would come apart and they'd lose it. And so she had seen those attributes in him, and so she could know what the guy was really capable of, all the things he was made of, and she could miss those things that she respected. Full life.
Yeah, very full life. She is a person who knows that when the going gets tough, she gets going. And that seems to be something that I think probably harkens back to what happened in the resistance. She knew that if she was going to stay alive, there were certain ways she had to conduct her life.
Well, it was interesting. The last sentence in the book, which she said to me, she realizes certain things about herself. Marisa, as I said, was her code name in the underground. And she said, "I am still Marisa, and Marisa is me," period.
Yeah.
And so I felt good that in the process of doing this, she could get back in touch with so many of those rich experiences in her lives, even the ones that were dramatically negative, but they were formative. Mm-hmm. And she was able, and she admits it's very late in her life to do this, but able to come into touch with her own strengths and to realize that what attributes she herself possessed. And I felt really good to be a part of that.
How did she choose the name Marisa?
I'm not sure whether she did or it was assigned to her.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure we ever discussed that. She just said that was my name. And, you know, she, again, even on the cover of the book, we have her ID card. It's the original one. She still has it that's got her name on it. So it's, you know, she's, every once in a while, she'll pull this stuff out, just go through it, and it sort of brings back to life all these experiences from so many years ago.
It has to be fascinating to wander through somebody's life, or to allow them to help you to wander through their life, and then to say, okay, we've got a story here. We've got not only a life, but we've got a life that can be shared with others. And maybe that sharing of her courage, of Margarita's and Marissa's courage, can cause someone else who's reading this book to get in touch with their courage.
It's what was fascinating to me, among other things, was when we first contemplated doing this, Margarita said, "I just want my story to be told before I'm gone." Once the book was published and she held a hardcover copy in her hand, it became something much more important to her. She has worked tirelessly to talk to people about the book. She's given away dozens of copies. She's brought them to Italian art fairs here in Phoenix and Scottsdale. She's very impassioned about the book because I think she looks at this book as being, what can I say, the representation of her whole life in one handheld thing.
Yeah.
And it's just taken on an importance in her life that I don't think she even contemplated before we decided to do this.
Well, it's spurred her on. What has it done for you? Has it made you want to write more?
Absolutely. As I'd mentioned to you earlier before we were on air, I wrote a second book that actually came about because another Italian-American gentleman living in Scottsdale had known Margarita through an Italian society here in town and asked me if I would come talk with him about writing his life story. And I did. Unfortunately, the man passed away before we were able to do anything with the book to get it published. So it's still up in the air whether anything will go there. But the other thing I have to tell you about, though, is for Christmas, my younger daughter gave me a gift. There's a service called Storyworth, and she paid for this. And what they do once a week is they email me a question about my life. And then I write the answer to that question. It's not just a question, but I write pages.
Mm-hmm.
And then I submit that, and they distribute it to my wife, my two daughters, and they save them. And at the end of the year, they're going to put all of them together in a book. So this is a stimulation for me to think about things I might not have thought about. And they said, by the way, when we send you this question this week, if that's not a question you're comfortable with, just go to our website and pick any question you want and respond to it. So it's just been like, you know, like a can opener. You just kind of twist it open and there's a little bit more coming in and a little bit more. Oh, wow, look at that. And oh, I would never have thought about that. What's my favorite meal? You know, I grew up in a German household surrounded by Germans. And yet the best German meal I ever had was here in Phoenix. Not cooked by family. And so I wouldn't have thought about that,
yeah.
But it made me think about what was my favorite meal. We were not wealthy, so when I was growing up, Friday nights were either potato pancakes and applesauce or hot dogs and beans.
Oh.
And I love that. I absolutely love that. But when
that's
I think
not of... potato pancakes may be German, but hot dogs...
German and Jewish a little bit.
Okay.
There's a... Both my girls now live in Connecticut. We were up there last week, and there's a Jewish deli, the deli restaurant that has potato pancakes in there. It's the only restaurant I've ever been in that had potato pancakes. So everybody else is ordering Reubens and this, that, and the other thing, and I'm sitting there with my potato pancakes and applesauce. But when I think about it, what I liked the most was this dish out there called Jägerschnitzel. Jäger in German is a hunter. And so this is a very thin cutlet, and the spice, the sauce on it is so, so good. I'd never had this as a child. It is so good. And then, of course, with red cabbage and potato dumplings.
Oh, does sound German.
So, but anyway, to get back to the writing part of it, anybody who has that kind of well of memories, either write it yourself or talk to somebody about writing it for you. It's just a cathartic experience.
If you had to write this story all over again, I mean, is there anything you would change, alter, add, anything at all?
Well, as we've both commented earlier before we went on air, the book leads one to believe it's going to be about her life in the resistance. And actually, that was 2 years of her life out of the 90-plus that she's lived since, or total. I think I would go back and make it more about that resistance. Mm-hmm. I would try to ask her then, do you know anybody else that I could talk with that might have been experienced that I could get some more details about, some other things going on. I might want to add, because all of her experiences were in and around Torino. Obviously, the resistance movement was all throughout Italy. I would have liked to go out and find out some other groups around in different parts of Italy and their participation. In fact, this other book that I had written, which has not gone anywhere so far, The gentleman was from Sicily, and so...
Is that near Torino?
No, no. Sicily is the football right off the tip of the Italian boot. Mm-hmm. So, and Torino is way up north. It's near the Alps. You can see the Alps from Torino. Mm-hmm. So it's two very different parts of Italy. But the Allied invasion there, the resistance movement that helped get the Germans out and helped the Allies move up north into Italy proper. Again, I alluded earlier to the fact that I had no idea of all of this going on. When the Italians surrendered, if you will, when they changed sides in 1943, September 1943, the Germans demanded that all of the Italian army people now report to the Wehrmacht. Most of them turned tail and ran up into the hills. People accepted them up there, gave them civilian clothes, and they become now very active, militarily trained resistance fighters. So it was that time, and I never knew this. I have no idea whatsoever about the courage these people showed, the influence they had. When the Germans fled Italy, finally, through the north, through Brenner Pass, they fled because the resistance movement had said, if you surrender, if you release all your prisoners and you do not do a scorched earth policy, we will let you go out unmolested. And the Germans realized, because the resistance had become so effective, this was a golden opportunity for them, and they did. Unfortunately for them, at least, the Allies came up right behind them and caught them. But the resistance movement didn't touch them because they had pledged not to, and because the Germans took them at their word. That, and the Germans valued what the resistance could have done to them and then what was open to them with the pledge not to do anything. Mm-hmm. So it became a very, very effective movement. And again, growing up as a kid, I knew none of this, absolutely none of this. Yeah. I was so impressed with that. And Mrs. de Blasio's book, by the way, was also very illuminating about that sort of thing. And then the other research that I did, it was just eye-opening.
Did any of your research take you to Italy, or did you do all the research online and through books and interviews?
All the latter. I didn't get over there. I've been to Italy exactly one time in my life, and it was a very brief snapshot. I came into Milan from New York overnight, had a lunch meeting, flew down to Rome, stayed in a hotel, flew over to Sardinia the next day, back to Rome that night, the next day back to New York.
So you didn't see much of anything.
Didn't get to see anything at all. So that's bucket list.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any ideas for other books that you'd like to write? Anything more that you're thinking about at this time?
I tell you what, I'm more interested in, say, writing shorter pieces often. So doing a blog or something like that. I'm very much, I don't want to get into it in this program, but I'm very much concerned about politics in this country and the divisiveness that seems to be developing. And I'm feeling this theme come about of some sort of a blog type thing where the underlying theme is connection. Mm-hmm. And the strength that so overwhelms divisiveness, if we simply let it, to connect us together. You and I are sitting right here looking into each other's eyes talking, and we're connecting. Mm-hmm. You can't do that with emojis.
That's true.
But we're also of a generation where we remember what that was like. We remember not having these other alternatives. Younger kids are growing up today. I'm almost thinking, why not have a weekend away where you put your phone aside and you just talk with people and you shake hands with them and you hug them and you eat with them? And
well, the whole resistance, going back to Marissa's courage, the whole resistance is based on connection.
Absolutely.
Everything had to be worked close, very close-knit, in order for the resistance to be as successful as it was.
And there were examples in there that we even referred to. Basically, because of my background research, I inserted these things where political opponents, the communists versus the socialists versus the Christian Democrats, they surrendered all of that to become one in the resistance. It reemerged after the war was over, but during the war, they surrendered all of that, all those allegiances to become allied with their compatriots.
And it's interesting that you say that, because when I talk to other veterans, because I do that occasionally, they talk about what happens, I'm going to just use a general term, in the trenches.
Sure.
And there is no divisiveness. It's all, everybody's working together, a unified team, and they have a common goal. And those friendships, if they hadn't met in a war zone, would never have occurred. And so, yeah, connection is extremely important.
In the book, Margarita's father was an ardent anti-fascist. But in those days, you couldn't be very public about that. But the connections were made with other anti-fascists who would meet over dinner or in a bar or something like that. And those connections became all the stronger because they were necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are times where those connections need to be allowed to happen. I think that that's stuff that's in the human species, you know, that predates technology. And we need to give that voice. And hopefully people can read this book or listen to the book and come away with an understanding or maybe a deeper sense of how important that is.
I agree. Yeah. I agree 100%. I wish that there could be more understanding and more connection.
Sure. Yeah.
And Marissa certainly made that point in her book, even when she was at odds with her husband or when she was at odds with her mother, she was able to still stay closely connected to them.
Absolutely.
And love them to the end.
And she even said that, and it's in the book, about how when her mother passed away, that she, you know, she could remember all those other things, but there was an overwhelming sense of love and devotion to her mother.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thank you very much. This has been an extremely interesting interview on Marissa's courage, and your writing of the book and your telling of Marissa's story has really been very interesting, and I appreciate having read the book and having had the opportunity to read it for our listeners. I hope that they will enjoy it as much as I did.
Well, I do too, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to come in here and talk about it. And in preparation to reread the book.
Well, thanks again. We have been talking with Bill Diekman, who is the author, in conjunction with Margarita Frey, in the book Marissa's Courage. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I hope you've enjoyed our interview as much as I've enjoyed doing it with Bill Diekman.
Thanks, Joyce. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.